Hey Dan, should I invest all of my money in rentals and fix and flips?
Only if you're looking to go into debt and start a second business in highly illiquid assets. Welcome to Fleece Vests, where we talk about how real estate isn't easy money. I'm Dan, and no, you shouldn't put all your money into anything you don't already know how to do.
I'm Jess, and my formative experience with rentals was when I was a kid. My mom paid me a penny for every carpet nail I pulled up in our rental property, which we had to do after our tenant trashed the place. And that's probably the only time anybody made any money on that property. It definitely came in handy, though, when I had to rip some carpets up in our house last year, though.
Well, hey, it's a life skill you built as a child, you know. So, Jess, I mean, let's be honest. You know that I'm not a fan of real estate investing by the average person. So why ask?
Yeah, so there's a ton of content out there on the internet, YouTube, TikTok, all over the place, really, on how to get started with real estate investing, with everything from sourcing fix and flip deals, DIY renovation guides, and even house hacking for buying places like duplexes or single family homes with an additional dwelling unit. There's all this material shouting nonstop that real estate is an easy, low risk, and reliable way to build wealth.
And of course, we know that nothing is that easy.
Exactly. But I wanted to hear your thoughts on why real estate isn't easy money. It seems like just about anybody can buy it. You can borrow money pretty easily to get started. And in some cases, it seems like you don't even really have to put much work into it. So what's the problem here?
I think first and foremost, we probably have to make a disclaimer here for the skeptical real estate investor who thinks that we are about to spend the next 10 or 20 minutes shellacking the whole idea of real estate investing. There is nothing intrinsically wrong with real estate investing. It's a classic asset class that not only provides a needed good for many in the form of housing for limited time periods or housing that they might not be otherwise able to access or afford if they had to buy it, but also one that has helped build enormous wealth throughout the United States over its history.
You're really not convincing me that I shouldn't go out and buy a duplex, Dan.
Okay, disclaimers are over now. Let's talk about the problems with real estate investing, and there are many problems. I think it's easiest to break this down into four major points: risk and return expectations, tenant nightmares, house flipping nightmares, and the utilization of leverage in an investment portfolio.
I'm dying of anticipation, Dan, but couldn't you start this off with something more fun than risk and return expectations?
Nope. Because risk and return is what this is all about. Simply put, real estate as an asset class returns about as well as the broader stock market. Now, that includes everything from single family homes to office parks, so there's a wide variety of real estate captured in that statement. Personal residences tend to return about the rate of inflation when you account for the cost of a mortgage dragging on appreciation, and some real estate is incredibly valuable simply for its location or increasing supply, or rather a lack of supply relative to the demand in the local area. And other real estate simply never really appreciates in value because it's in an undesirable area, or it's in an area that's declining in its desirability.
If it's not doing any better than the broader stock market, what's all the fuss about?
Well, because there are always exceptions and extremes. Risk is defined in the investing world as getting an actual rate of return that deviates from your expected return. The more risk, the more potential deviation, which can be positive in the form of increased returns or negative in the form of bigger losses or simply just lower than expected returns. Real estate, particularly directly held real estate, is an asset that's purchased in large dollar amounts, and that can have both a cash flow component, an appreciation component, and even some tax advantages that help make the cash flow even more beneficial. The problem is that when you see examples of people sharing their investment portfolios outsized returns or their real estate portfolios outsized returns, what you're not seeing are the properties on the other side of the risk return spectrum, which are probably losing significant amounts of money at any given time.
Well, sure, we have Instagram and social media to thank for all of us sharing the highlights of our lives rather than downsides. But surely real estate is valuable enough on its own, right? The building, the land it's on, etc., provides some amount of downside protection, doesn't it?
I mean, yes and no. From an appreciation of value standpoint, I would say yes, because on some level, you at least always own the dirt. There's a structure or something like that. But from the standpoint of cash flow, absolutely not. You can be losing quite a bit of money at all given times.
Are we getting towards nightmare tenants now?
Exactly. So let me just pose a couple hypotheticals to you, Jess.
Okay, hit me.
Has an S&P 500 exchange-traded fund ever let the pipes freeze in your home?
Nope.
Has Apple or Microsoft ever destroyed the walls of your home or, let's say, ripped out all copper piping?
Definitely not.
Have you ever had a U.S. Treasury bond cook meth in your basement?
I think we get the point, Dan. Conventional securitized investments aren't going to destroy your personal property and leave it uninhabitable.
Well, and that's just to start, right? Those are the obvious nightmare tenants, right? The person who chain smokes in a non-smoking property or does drugs or runs criminal enterprises or whatever the case is. But what about the simply less than perfect tenants? You know, what about tenants who have dogs even though it's a no-dog property? You can take their security deposit and even go after them in court for damages that are caused, but you're still stuck replacing ruined carpets and scratched doors. And then there are those tenants with special circumstances, such as those who apply through Section 8 vouchers, those with accessibility issues, or other special circumstances that warrant exceptions to what otherwise might be a well-thought-out harm mitigation plan you had for your property.
Oh man, major flashback to my childhood again. One of our tenants had a Doberman, which was definitely against the no-dog rule we had, and clogged the tub with dog food when they left. So that was super fun. But maybe they just didn't have a dog bowl. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too mean. So anyway, people still need a place to live, though, Dan. So some exceptions have to be made here.
Well, sure. But then you get into the worst case scenario, not just a tenant who is destroying the property or causing it damage, but one who will not pay and who abuses the legal process to remain in place. I mean, there are countless stories of people gaming the housing system and the eviction system to squat in properties for months or even years without paying rent or otherwise just making the investment cash flow positive. And that's not even getting into subleases, which are known to you or hidden from you as the property owner, in which tenants might have sublet to other tenants with shoddy or even non-existent lease agreements, ultimately leaving you saddled with a messy pile of legal fees and housing rights to navigate.
It could be worse, though. You could just have a property that isn't renting, right?
Is it sad to say that the property being empty isn't as bad as some of these nightmare tenants? But even then, vacancy can be a real issue, right? Buying a property that costs you several thousand dollars in monthly mortgage, insurance, and taxes seems like a fine investment if the home is rented and all those costs are covered. But if you don't have tenants, then you're stuck with that property. And I've seen countless clients go out and buy an Airbnb-style vacation home under the assumption that they could just rent it out to offset their full cost, only to end up shelling out thousands of dollars in expenses monthly when it turns out that the property simply doesn't do as well as they'd hoped or that it's seasonal.
Yeah, and plus you're not living in it anymore, so you're losing the main benefit of what we spend our money on when we spend money on housing. But regardless, what you've described so far is just based on the idea of buying properties to rent out. What about fix and flips or, you know, house flipping? You see old fixer-uppers going for sale all the time, being bought by flippers and, God help us all, then being turned around for a cool six-figure gain in the sales price. That surely avoids a lot of the rental problems you described.
I mean, herein we get into the territory of not just starting a business, but having a second job. If you come from a handyman or a trades background, fix and flipping might be right up your alley because you have the skill set. You can put in sweat equity, apply those skills that you already have, right, to improving a home and make it more attractive to buyers. However, the reality is that most people don't have handyman or trade skills. In fact, probably less people have those today than decades ago, and will either be learning on the job or resorting to using contractors. Now, in total fairness, some flippers do such a high volume of fix and flip work and are so disciplined in their approach that they make really good use of contractors to multiply the deals that they can complete. But whether it's the cost of learning and the mistakes you make along the way, or the costs of hiring contractors you hope can do a good job, or even just the opportunity costs of not doing your actual day job and doing fix and flipping instead, fix and flipping still requires an enormous amount of work, time, money, and skill. All the while, you are sitting on an expensive, concentrated asset and assuming that the marketplace for real estate will remain level or even improve so that you can sell your newly improved property at a gain.
Which is, despite what TikTok tells you, not a guarantee. So while we are seeing unprecedented jumps in the real estate market, houses do go down in value, something we've talked about before on this podcast, and something I have direct experience with.
And that's the kind of risk you can't really control for. I mean, don't get me wrong. All investment requires assumptions and relies on an optimistic set of expectations for the outcome. But not only do you have to do the work, carry the cost of the property and the work, and then sell at a profit, you are dependent upon the marketplace to support what you had always planned to sell the property for. And that simply isn't a guarantee.
Yeah. So then you're stuck holding onto the property until things hopefully get better, or you just cut your losses.
And therein, we probably have to come back to the most central mechanism for real estate investing, which is leverage. Most of our listeners would simply call these mortgages, but leverage is an important term in the investing world. Simply put, taking on debt to make investments magnifies the returns in excess of the capital you personally bring to the table.
And magnifies the losses in the event of a downside, right? So the only difference is you don't get to ignore paying back your debts if you lose money.
And that's the biggest risk at play here. Real estate is often attractive to new investors because they're told that they just need a little money for a down payment and they can borrow other people's money. It's always other people's money, by the way. It's never your money. It's always other people's money. But they can borrow other people's money to make up the difference. And that's not untrue. But it also means that a first-time real estate investment borrower will probably be taking on a level of risk that means that if the investment goes south, they will probably be financially devastated, if not outright bankrupted by the opportunity that went wrong.
I love spending other people's money. It's one of my favorite things. But seriously, I guess the question here is, though, is that worth it? You know, so many of these influencers in the real estate space will talk about the easy money, using other people's money and building up your wealth. But real estate is just like any other high risk, high reward opportunity, which has to be filled with the silent graveyard of investments gone bad and people getting wiped out, right? We don't just hear about it because people don't start million follower TikTok channels about going bankrupt. I guess unless you're Dave Ramsey for that matter.
I mean, maybe we should do that.
Yeah. Dan, we already have a really depressing podcast. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, okay? So anyway, is there any world in which the claim that real estate is passive income is true?
Not really, at least not at the scale most people are going to do it. There comes a point at which you could own so much real estate that any of the predictable expenses or risks are simply a cost of doing business at that scale, and you probably net out just fine. But frankly, if you're going to concentrate so heavily into a real estate asset class, at that point, you might as well look at real estate investment trusts or other investment products that are professionally managed and help mitigate that over-concentrated and over-leveraged risk at play when you directly invest in specific individual holdings of real estate.
So like Dan said right at the beginning, you can definitely make a lot of money in real estate. It's just a risky enterprise, and you should never assume that any type of investing is going to be extra easy, safe, and result in sustainable risk-free passive income. But if you feel like starting a second job as a handyman or enjoy the possibility of getting sued by one of your investments customers, try out real estate.
Fleece Fests is produced by Daniel Yerker and Jessica Gettle. Daniel Yerker is an investment advisor representative of My Wealth Planners, a registered investment advisor in Colorado, and Jessica Gettle is an investment advisor representative of Pavilion Financial Planning, a registered investment advisor in Pennsylvania. Our theme song is Dr. Yes by Yari. Nothing discussed in this podcast is investment advice or any other form of advice, and the podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. If you make investments or other financial decisions because of the podcast, frankly, you weren't listening.
All right, I don't want to add more depressing shit to this podcast, but I just finished last night a book. It's called Evicted by Matthew Desmond. And if we still haven't convinced you about out of being a landlord, please just read this book. And actually, you should just read it anyway. It was very good.
Adding to the Amazon cart now.